Good afternoon, and welcome to the meeting of the Privacy and Proxy Services Accreditation Issues PDP Working Group. Breathe, exhale. This is a group that I'm Steve Metallitz. I'm one of the co-chairs of this group, or interim co-chairs. Graham Bunton is my colleague with the same role. We have here many of the people who have been active participants in the working group, but there are still a few seats. The seats are not reserved for members of the working group, so if you would like to come up to the table, and particularly if you're planning to make a contribution, that might be easier to come up to the table. You're welcome. You're welcome to do so. I think our plan for this afternoon is to move fairly briskly through the main points of the initial report of this working group, which was published early in May, I guess. I don't remember the exact date, and is open for public comment until July 7th. We have received, I'm told, 6,000 comments so far, of which 5,999 are virtually identical, but we are hoping for a robust public comment period and to get a lot of input on our initial report so that we can, Graham and I were just talking about getting back on schedule for our weekly meetings next month so that we can hopefully drive this promptly toward a final report that would be able to go to the GNSO Council. So anyway, our plan was to kind of walk through some of the main issues in the report, and my suggestion is that if people have questions or comments, they could raise them at the point that we talk about that particular item. We'll keep an eye on the time and make sure we cover everything. And one other element that we may bring in here at least a little bit is we've received a lot of helpful input since the report was published from the staff, looking at this kind of from an operational perspective, raising some questions. A lot of these are implementation questions, but I think it's very valuable to have that input now as we move toward a final report so that we get a sense of what, you know, some of the implementation issues are. So it's possible we'll ask the staff to comment a bit on that and at least let people know that these operational questions are also, you know, kind of in the mix. So unless Graham has any opening comments, maybe we should just get started. And I think you were going to start, I think, on the slides. I'm happy to if you wish.
What is the first slide?
Well, we'll ask for the first slide.
Oh, sure. So I don't have any more general opening comments. That was an excellent introduction. Thank you, Steve. A bit of background for those of us who haven't been traveling all the way down the road of this working group. So there's the 2013 accreditation agreement. It has a interim specification that expires January 1st, 2017, which means we need to complete this PDP and get implementation completed prior to that date, or the status quo will reign. And we're at the moment very much aware of that timeline. So it was chartered in October. We began our first meetings in December of 2013 and have been 60-plus meetings since then. As Steve said, we published our initial report May 5th, open comment period till July 7th. Please read the report and provide us with your input. We need it very much. Let's keep going. Next slide. Ah, thank you. So there's a list there I'm not going to read for you all of other pieces of work that we've looked into and brought on board in our discussions. The working group's been made up of all the GNSO stakeholder groups, members of at-large. We've had some input from law enforcement, as well as just individuals. So it's been a great array of people and voices inside the working group, often interesting times. Right, there we go on our initial report. So the initial report is a pretty broad summary, and we're going to go through that now, but the key bits are some really large open questions that we've put forth to the community, and we'll discuss a bit, I'm sure, here today. And those are really what we're looking for input on. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, please.
Thank you. This is Steve Metallitz again. And by the way, I know we have people, or I'm assuming we have people in the Adobe room, so Mary, if you will just let us know if people there have any questions that they want to ask, and we'll manage the queue here for people in the room, and please feel free if you have a question. our group, which was very diverse and also hardworking, I'd have to say, did reach consensus on a lot of the charter questions that we were given, and this just gives you a little bit of a summary of the initial report. You know, the whole document is very thick, but if you read the executive summary, you will get all of the recommendations, and you'll also get pointed to a couple of annexes that are quite important. I'll just mention two of those. One is Annex E, which we'll talk about later in the presentation, and that is an illustrative framework for handling disclosure requests from intellectual property rights holders. One of the main issues in this whole area is, what are the circumstances under which a privacy or proxy service provider, if it's accredited, should be revealing to a requester the information on its customer. In other words, the kind of information that would appear in publicly accessible who is, but for the fact that the registration has been made as a proxy registration or a privacy registration. So that's obviously an issue we spent much of our time on, and this annex gives an illustrative framework, just one example of how this could be handled for one type of disclosure request from intellectual property rights holders. And as we will discuss when we get there, there are obviously a lot of other entities or interests that might make such requests. Annex F is also important because it lays out two viewpoints within the working group on an important question about whether customers who use proxy registrations should be prohibited or restricted from carrying out certain kinds of activities, notably commercial transactions, using a website to which that domain name resolves, for example. So we will get to that, but there's some brief statements from various members of the working group that kind of lay that out, and that's certainly one big issue on which we are seeking comment. Next slide, please. Oh, you got it. So we are using the terms privacy and proxy service, which were defined in some of the earlier research that ICANN commissioned, and you'll see that we basically decide that both these types of services should be treated the same, but this is the definition. And then we have some new terms that are quite important to understand. One is relay. Again, that's a term that's been used a lot in this context, but it really refers to a situation where a third party wants to send a message electronically to the customer, in other words, the proxy registrant, if you will, or the customer of the privacy proxy service, and they can't contact them directly because that information is not in who is. So the relay process is, which Graham will talk about in more detail, I believe, that's what that refers to. And then we came into this exercise using the term relay and reveal, and it was soon revealed to us that many people couldn't, that term still required greater definition. So here's what we came to, and we tried to use these consistently throughout the report, which was a challenge, but with the staff's help, I think we've succeeded in being consistent. And disclosure we're using to mean revealing the contact information of the customer to a third-party requester, but only to that requester and with restrictions on how that information can be used, only to resolve the issue that gave rise to it, for example. And publication would be publishing it. In other words, putting it in the who is. It's tantamount to ending or terminating the customer's privacy and proxy service, and then it becomes public. And law enforcement authority, we just copied the definition that's in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, which again refers to it's got a jurisdictional aspect to it. So that's another definition that we just shamelessly adopted from other work that had been done. Next slide, please. Okay, I've already mentioned that we didn't really find any place where we needed to treat privacy services different from proxy services. Obviously, if you think of one, please let us know in the public comment process. This whole issue of permissible uses, really, there's a threshold issue, which is, are certain entities or certain registrants allowed or not allowed to use a privacy and proxy service? And where we came out as a consensus matter, I believe, on that is really the status quo, which is whether you're commercial or a non-commercial, an organization or an individual, you are eligible to use these services. Where we didn't reach agreement is whether there are restrictions on what you can do once, you know, with that domain name once you have it. So we'll get to that. We did adopt a recommendation that the domain names that are involved here would be labeled as such in who is, so that people who access the public who is would be able to know whether they're dealing with proxy registrations, privacy registrations, or not. And this is one area where the staff and their operational feedback has raised a good question, which is who has the responsibility to ensure that the labeling is done? Is that the registrar or the service provider? This is a good question because right now, of course, we're looking at this through the lens of a situation in which the service providers are virtually, if not always, entities affiliated with registrars. But that might not necessarily be the case in the future. We could have an accredited privacy or proxy service provider that's not affiliated with an accredited registrar. So that's an example of the kind of question that we appreciate the staff bringing up, and I'm not going to put Owen and other staff members on the spot here, but there are staff folks here who may be able to answer questions if people have it about some of their observations. One important recommendation, I think, is that the privacy proxy registrations are to be validated or verified in the same way that non-privacy registrations are under the Who Is Accuracy specification. Again, to the extent that these services are operated by accredited registrars, they should not present that much of a problem. It's a question of what you call the customer whose contact information you need to validate or verify. It could get more complicated, obviously, in the case of an independent accredited privacy proxy service provider. And the staff pointed out that the Who Is Accuracy specification might change. I know that that's being discussed right now. I think, personally, it would be a terrible mistake if the Who Is Accuracy specification were changed, but it would not be the first time that ICANN had done something that I thought was a terrible mistake. So, all we're saying is let's keep it simple. You have to do with these what you would have to do if you were a registrar and it was just a standard non-proxy registration. And then we talk about some mandatory provisions that have to be included and published in the terms of service. Graham mentioned that we now have an interim specification in the Registrar Accreditation Agreement to deal with some of these services. And that includes a requirement that certain types of policy information, terms of service, be published and be abided by. So this is similar in that sense, but I think we do list in specifically the services have to tell the customers, what are the grounds under which there could be disclosure or publication, what are the circumstances under which their service might be terminated, what are their rights and responsibilities, and so on. So that's another one of our consensus recommendations. I think we can. We are already on the next one. Thank you. We recommended that ICANN maintain a public list of all the accredited providers. ICANN does that now with registrars. It doesn't do it with these services. So this would be helpful for anybody trying to figure out, you know, who is this service and who runs the service and everything. And that the providers would, we'd have to have greater transparency about when a provider has an affiliation with a registrar. Again, that's the norm today, that most of these services are provided by affiliates or subsidiaries of registrars. So we wanted to facilitate that, as you can see. Provider has to maintain an abuse contact point and publish that on its website. We did have some discussion about whether that had to be dedicated with the implication that this person would do nothing else but this, or just simply designated, you know, this person does this, they may have other responsibilities. We came out for designated, and then that they had to be capable and authorized basically to deal with the problems that might arise, and that is defined in the inter-registrar transfer policy. So once again, we've tried to repurpose some of what ICANN policy development has already dealt with rather than trying to reinvent the wheel. And again, if this is a topic where you think that's not the right definition, we would love to hear that from members of the public. And then what do these contact points do? They need to respond to reports of malicious conduct. That while we don't have an exhaustive definition of that, we do have some starting points that are listed there from the registry agreement, from the GAC safeguards. I think there's actually a little more to that slide, but you'll see you'll see this all in the report to indicate what this designated contact point is responsible for. So I think that brings us to Relay, which does not appear on the title of that slide, but it does appear in the report. So let me turn it back to Graham to talk about that.
Thanks, Steve. I put you on the hook for a lot of talking there. So Steve gave the definition earlier for Relay, but let's just make sure we're all on the same page there. So Relay is a third party is sending communications via the proxy or privacy provider to the registrant. And so they are relaying some form of communications. So we have a number of agreed recommendations here, and then we still have a couple open questions on Relay that we posed to you guys here and is also in the report, and we can have some discussion there as well if there are questions. So the service provider has to relay to the customer all communications required by ICANN consensus policies or the RAA, which makes perfect sense. So that's WDRP notices and renewal notices and those sorts of things. We have an option here, and the distinction might be a little bit subtle, but service providers must also either relay all electronic communications but can apply commercially reasonable safeguards against spam or abuse, or all electronic communications from law enforcement or third parties alleging abuse. So that gives you the ability to just relay everything, or you can just relay law enforcement and abuse requests and how you choose to implement that sort of thing is up to you. What you're essentially trying to do there is remove unwarranted communications or unwanted communications from your registrant. Requester will be notified of a persistent delivery failure of electronic communications. So this is in the scenario where the registrant's email might be failing, for instance. And the provider is aware of it, that they would then have to tell the requester that the delivery notification has failed, or the delivery of that communication has failed persistently. I don't think we've defined that in any more detail. Now, that would almost certainly kick off the registrant verification procedure as well, probably in the background, if privacy and proxy providers have to abide by that standard, which we said they should. Right, and that's the next bullet point. I'm getting ahead of myself. Right, actually, we can go on. Thanks, Mary. So we have a pretty big open question here, and I'll read this out and post it to the community. So where you see square brackets is where we have an option that we're looking at. So this is around the escalation process for where Relay has failed and the third party wishes to seek another form of communication with the registrant. So as part of an escalation process, and when the above-mentioned requirements concerning a persistent delivery failure of an electronic communication have been met, the provider should, or the provider must, upon request, forward a further form of notice to its customer. A provider should have the discretion to select the most appropriate means of forwarding such a request, brackets, and to charge a reasonable fee on a cost recovery basis. Continuing on with the brackets, any such reasonable fee is to be borne by the customer and not the requester. Provider shall have the right to impose a reasonable limits on the number of such requests made by the same requester. So you can't escalate forever all the time. There are limits on that. The should or must determines whether we are forcing the provider to forward a further form of notice to their customer. And then we have a rather contentious issue of who should pay for that sort of relay. And in many cases, we might be talking about physical mail. And therefore, these processes are not free. They would certainly have some sort of cost. And it's around who should bear that cost, whether it is the third party who is trying to communicate, whether it's the service provider, or possibly even the registrant. So that is the sort of main open question that's out there on Relay. I can't read the... What's the...
So this is review.
Ah, okay. So do we want to pause for a moment on Relay? Let's see if we've got any hands. I see Volker and Elliot and Michele. There's our cue. Volker, you're up first.
I have a more general point to make about the accreditation system, but I'm going to hold that until the open questions open. With regard to Relay and the costs involved, I would strongly recommend that these costs should be borne by the requester, if only for the reason if they would have sent the postal mail from themselves to the registrant directly, they would also have borne that cost.
Elliot Noss, Two Cows. Two comments on the relay. The first is with respect to, and I'll just ask them both, Steve, if you could speak to them. The first is on the shifting of the cost burden. When demonstrably in numerous different community processes previously, it's been shown empirically that the vast majority of complaints that tended to be the type of complaint that will be the subject matter here are not successful or not with merit, and with merit's wrong, with merit's too strong, but our demands that don't actually lead to a conclusion that's asked for. What's the argument for shifting the cost burden? Let me get the answer to the first one.
Did you have a second question too, or do you?
Yeah, I do, but okay. It's totally separate.
Yeah, first, I don't really accept your premise and about what's been empirically shown. But remember where this fits in. This is only in a situation where there's some electronic form of communication, either email or a web form that's used, and it doesn't work, and persistently doesn't work. So I think the social contract that we're talking about here is that people who use a privacy or proxy registration should provide a way to be contacted electronically, and if they fail to do that, it doesn't seem fair to assign the cost of that to a third party that isn't the reason for that failure. So it either needs to be built into the, again, I'm providing this the other point of view here, it either needs to be built into the cost of the service, or it needs to be imposed in some way on the customer who's basically necessitated this escalation. So that I think is my answer to your first question.
Would you be open to, or would it be helpful if in the comment period some of that empirical data was provided? In other words, you know, if it was the case that the significant majority of, let me call them demands or demand letters for lack of a better phrase, you know, are just that, shot over the bow at first instance, would that change your thinking or influence your thinking?
I don't think it would change my thinking, but you're certainly welcome to include anything of that sort in your comments, and I think the working group would be interested in seeing that. And
the second question is, well, it's maybe more of a comment. It seems that the use of mail here, and I think, you know, we might go back to that social contract, feels very, you know, U.S. or North American-centric. In the sense, so there's sort of two pieces to that. One is that globally, you're going to have very, you know, varied costs, very long delivery processes. In parts of the developing world, certainly the communication between a service provider and their customer could take many forms, including face-to-face. And so I feel like there's a range to be fit in there. And the second comment about mail in particular is it feels deeply anachronistic. You know, I think that people would strongly prefer other means of communication today. You know, mail in North America, in the developed world, tends to be, you know, a pile of flyers these days. And I'm wondering if there's some other way to think about communication. I mean, it feels anachronistic, and what would I call it? You know, it's nice for a legal file, but probably won't get your practical point across.
Okay, thank you, Elliot. I think the working group would be open to alternatives of other means of communicating to customers once electronic mail or a web form has failed, and I'm certainly very comfortable saying that this escalation would not include buying the requester a ticket to get on an airplane and meet face-to-face with the customer. So I think we can probably we would welcome your suggestions on that and can probably respond to those. I think you're maintaining the queue at this point. Before you do that, can I just acknowledge that we do have people in the chat room, and I'm sure Mary will tell us. Oh, okay. Some person is
Stephanie,
who's in the room, has raised her hand, but also people who aren't physically here. And I want to acknowledge that one of those is Don Blumenthal, who is the chair of this working group and who wasn't unable to travel to here to Buenos Aires. But, Don, we welcome you. And of course, if you have any questions or contributions, we would welcome those, too. Graham.
Thanks, Steve. Actually, we're going to Michaela next, and then Stephanie is the queue at the moment.
Michaela Dalen, for the record. Thanks. So just actually going back a little to the previous section that Steve was presenting on the who is accuracy specification built into the contract, there is a review process, and we're currently going through that at the moment with ICANN. It's open for public comment. Some of the changes that we are proposing are just to make the entire thing more workable for all parties involved, including ICANN staff. One of the issues that arose in the review of this is that some of the terminology translates really, really, really badly, and that's causing headaches. So, you know, the thing is, most processes, most policies, reviewing them from time to time isn't a bad thing. Because, Steve, sometimes you will get something that you like. Not very often, and not when I'm in the room, but sometimes.
Thanks, Michaela. Stephanie?
Thanks very much. For the record, Stephanie Perrin. I just wanted to endorse Volker's statement. I think from a civil society perspective, we're deeply concerned that these services will be priced out of existence. The fact of the matter is, just because an email doesn't go through doesn't mean that the respondent is being unresponsive. This is an untrusted platform. Email doesn't always work. And therefore, you have to revert to the other methods. Yes, they cost money, but we don't see any reason to see why those costs should be transferred in this particular environment. Thanks.
Okay. We've got Alex next, and then David, and then we might carry on.
Hi, this is Alex Deacon from the MPAA for the record. Like Steve, I don't agree that the cost should be borne by the complainant. I think if the issue that we're trying to solve here is to minimize bogus or malformed complaints, then there are other ways to fix that, probably simpler ways. For example, a trusted sender program may be one way to do that. So I think if that's the issue, then I think we have options to solve that problem.
As those who've been following this,
say your name.
Sorry, David Cake, and a member of the working group. As those who've been following this working group and participating will know that, in fact, we've had quite a lot of extensive debates about exactly how and when email fails and its utility and under what conditions you can know that it hasn't been delivered and so on. And early on, some pretty interesting examples of the edge cases of physical communication, you know, people sending, you know, several feet of documentation and things like that. So we have thought quite a lot about all the failure modes, but I think the question really is about the who bears the cost. And I think the thing we need to be aware of that we may be slipping into is trying to prescribe the business model of the provider. I can understand that if you are the requester, you want to have a relatively straightforward means available to you without additional fees. But whether it's born with a customer or the provider or, you know, there is some other mechanism is, I mean, I don't something we shouldn't be trying to control the many different method business models of proxy and privacy providers in the accreditation process and meddle too much in their internal accounting.
Thanks, David. I'm a little conscious this queue just keeps growing, and we want to do keep this bit short, so if you're still very interested, please keep your hand up. I've got Volker and then Michele, but let's try and keep it quick, and we can carry on and look at the rest of the report, please. Thanks.
Thank you. Volker Greimer speaking again for the record. Just one comment, which is that if there were no who is privacy for a complainant, for a domain name, and the complainant would send an email and find out that it failed, then he would also have to send physical mail or call by phone or any other utilize any other means at its own cost. And we're not talking about unreasonable fees. We are talking about a cost recovery fee here. So I don't see why the cost should suddenly be transferred to the registrant if those costs would have been borne by the complainant anyway.
Thank you. Michele's next.
Thanks, Michele, then, for the record. Now, just this thing around cost, I think it's a kind of ridiculous argument to be having in some respects, but not in others. We're talking about contracts here, so we're talking about what we can or cannot do. And so the thing is this, from my perspective, speaking for my own company, if you read our terms of service, you will see that we give ourselves the option to do certain things. That does not mean that we do that each and every single time. So, for example, if you were clever enough to realize that hosting with us was a good thing to do, and you had the misfortune of being reported on by SpamCop, within our terms of service, we can levy a fee. But the way we work that in reality is that unless you're a repeat offender and are just blatantly out there to, you know, abuse our servers, we don't. You know, you did it once, you screwed up, fine. I think for some of us, the cost recovery thing around this isn't so much a case of saying we must be able to do that. We are all going to charge you thousands of dollars or anything like that. But we should have the ability to recover the cost. Because as some people point out, you know, you don't want these services to become so ridiculously expensive that they're prohibitive to use. Or if I want to put on my human rights hat, which I was on a panel on earlier today, if it wasn't for the fact that I can blatantly insist on breaking European privacy law, we wouldn't have this problem to begin with. But I won't go down that track. I mean, the reality is that, you know, we need to have options. And having the option to be able to charge, I think, is a good thing.
I've got two more, and then I've got one more, and then I'm going to... You're still in? Okay, I got one more, and then we're going to carry on. Thank you. Christian?
There's some reasonable threshold at which you... Oh, my name is Christian Dawson with the ISPCP. There's some reasonable threshold at which you have contacted people through enough means that you have realized that the person is simply unreachable. When I sign up for a service with my healthcare provider in order to communicate with my doctor back and forth through digital means, I have to provide an email address and then a secondary email address and then a phone number and then a secondary phone number, and they're never going to send me a piece of mail. And all of those tools, if they use some sort of an IP phone in order to access me, it's all digital. And so the costs aren't really there. Can we create some sort of a structure in which there is a no-cost threshold, which is, I think, similar to what Elliot was saying about using modern means of communication?
Certainly something to consider. Thank you, Christian. All right, I think up next is... Steve and Reveal, please.
Thank you. This slide deals with Reveal, which, as we told you at the outset, is not a term we are using in the report, if we could help it. So we have definitions and distinctions between disclosure and publication. And as I mentioned before also, the recommendations include some information that the providers need to publish and also inform their customers of, and a lot of them have to do with this disclosure and publication, including whether the customer will be notified if their disclosure request is received, and including whether, as some providers do or may offer, particularly those that are affiliated with registrars, the option to cancel a domain name registration instead of having your contact information disclosed. Again, we're not requiring, these recommendations don't require providers to offer that option, but they do require them to tell the customers if they do offer that option. And in terms of customer notification, you'll see later that in the illustrative framework, customer notification is mandatory, but recognizing that that illustrative framework doesn't cover all kinds of requests, that's why we have in here this recommendation that the providers tell their customers, you know, whether they will be notified of disclosure requests. So I did mention, we have an illustrative framework for disclosure requests from trademark and copyright holders, and I would encourage you to look at that in Annex E of the report. And you'll see that at the outset of that it's intended to strike a balance among providing requesters a higher degree of certainty and predictability about what level of disclosure they can obtain, to preserve for service providers a sufficient degree of flexibility and discretion in acting on these requests, and to include reasonable safeguards and procedures to protect the legitimate interests and legal rights of the customers of these providers. So that was our goal, and we obviously are looking for your input on whether we have achieved it. I'm not going to go in great detail through these through what's in Annex E, since I don't think we have a slide for it, but basically it's trying to be as detailed as possible about how such requests would be handled. And if it's successful, hopefully it could provide some kind of template for other types of requests. But because the reason we chose this is that we had those people with expertise in this area around the table, and we didn't have as much expertise from some of the other requesters, such as law enforcement or from anti-phishing or malware, and we hope that those groups would kind of come up with the right framework for those types of requests, but we don't have that in our recommendations. So there are a number of questions that are open and that we're specifically seeking input from the community having to do with disclosure and publication, and some of these are listed here. I've already mentioned, what should the rules be for law enforcement requests? And in particular, we know that in the case, you'll see in the illustrative framework that in Annex E, that as I mentioned, customer notification is mandatory. If a trademark owner or copyright owner makes a request for the contact information of the customer, they will know, if, assuming this is all adopted, they will know that that customer will be notified. The request will be sent on to the customer, which is fine for those requests, but it's not necessarily fine for law enforcement requests in the middle of an investigation. They may feel very strongly that this should not be the customer should not be notified. So that we've invited comments on how to handle that issue. We had a question in our charter, I believe, about whether there should be certain types of misbehavior on the part of customers that would make publication mandatory. We didn't again make any recommendation on mandatory publication, recognizing that one of our goals was to preserve the flexibility and discretion for service providers to enforce their terms of service or not. McKaylee's absolutely right that just because the authority is there to enforce the terms of service doesn't mean it's always going to be enforced. But we welcome comments on that. There were some concerns about what would happen this is publication, it's really, I think, goes to disclosure. What would happen if information was disclosed either based on false pretenses or if the information was disclosed and then used in a manner, as I mentioned at the outset, any disclosure could only be used in order to address the issue that gave rise to the request, and what if we're used for marketing purposes or something like that, so what would the remedies be? And then we did have some specific questions about elements of the IP disclosure framework, some time frame issues, and then how to handle some of these disputes over wrongful disclosures that would result from false information or from misuse. So there are really two options in there about whether you are required to go to arbitration or would you have to submit to jurisdiction in a particular court. Here are some other questions that arise in the illustrative framework. Of course, the customer can object to the disclosure, and we're trying to come up with a reasonable, predictable, but flexible standard for when that sort of objection should prevail. And you see two different formulations there. One of them has three alternate adjectives, whether the reasons have to be adequate, sufficient, or compelling. And the other is more, a reasonable basis test. They both get at the same thing as to whether information has been brought forward that would justify, even though the elements of the request fully satisfy the requirements of this framework, and there is evidence of an intellectual property violation, what are the circumstances under which it could nevertheless be denied? And there are two different bullets there in bold, one because the customer might have objected, and the second might be that maybe the customer didn't, but the provider decided to refuse the request, and what would be the basis for doing that. But again, the illustrative framework goes into this in some detail about a number of reasons that could justify a refusal to disclose, a number of reasons that could not be relied upon solely to justify a refusal to disclose, and we would welcome your comments on any of those. I think that's the last slide on reveal. So let me again, and we can pause here if people have questions or comments that they wish to raise. And then again, if there are any in the chat room, you'll let us know. Dick, go ahead.
Please.
Dick Ling from the Public Safety Working Group. I am a law enforcement officer, and I'd just like to echo your comments about the disclosure of a request from a law enforcement to a service provider that tells the registrant that we've asked for that request, because that will frustrate any investigation that we'll ever have, and evidence destroyed, and it just can't happen under those circumstances. So we obviously will be making a comment through the process. And the other issue is about the jurisdiction part. I don't know if you want to comment on that now, or we'll come to that later about...
No. I think that would be appropriate now if you wanted to talk about that.
Regarding the jurisdiction issue, which at the moment the law enforcement request, and you can change law enforcement to whatever agency you want to use in the public safety arena, that if we're not allowed to make a request of a service provider outside of the jurisdiction, that's going to cause all public safety agencies a big headache. It'll get to such a stage that I'm from Scotland Yard, but I can't ask Scotland to reveal the details of their registrant without an MLAT. That is not workable. So there's issues about that jurisdiction. Now, I'm acutely aware of the difficulties of all service providers knowing every law enforcement agency in the world. If you look at America itself, it has 22,000 law enforcement agencies. Just because that's problematic, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't change that and look at some other mechanism that we can credit law enforcement, whatever that may be, or that type of agency. So it's not really a question, it's just a comment echoing the concerns that my members in the Public Safety Working Group, as we now called, have over this whole privacy proxy issue.
Thank you very much, Dick. And we would welcome your comments, those of your colleagues as well, on this. I think you've put your finger on a significant problem, and how best to resolve that. So we would look forward to your comments on that. I see Holly, and then Volker.
Just to make matters a little bit worse, some of the comments I've had have been an expansion of the concept of law enforcement agency. For example, you might have a government agency that looks over trade practice issues or financial prudential matters. Perhaps in the public interest issues, that kind of thing. They're not law enforcement, but they are charged with some aspects of, I think, public safety or public good. We haven't dealt with that issue, but I'm just flagging that that's been a comment that I've received in terms of how do we deal with those kinds of requests as opposed to, say, an individual request. Thanks.
Thank you, Holly. I think Volker was next. Did anybody else want to make a comment here?
Volker Greimann speaking for the record in response to the gentleman from the law enforcement agencies. I don't think the working group has in any way or form foreseen law enforcement agencies not being able to request this data outside the jurisdiction. The only thing that we have discussed is whether they should be given special powers that they do not have under the law. I would submit that a law enforcement agent that it would be acting outside its jurisdiction, without jurisdiction in general, would be treated as any other complainant, and therefore his complaints be looked at under their merits. If they wanted to have special powers granted to them, there's always the proper process of requiring legal assistance from law enforcement agencies where the privacy proxy service provider is situated. That is currently the legal government induced process. That's the process that has been followed by law enforcement agencies inside and outside the internet for decades now. Why should this change?
Thank you, Volker. Kieran, I think, is next, and then McKaylee.
So before I go, Kathy Kleiman put a question to the chat way in advance of me, so maybe you want to read her question first.
Could you do that, Mary? Thank you.
This is Mary from ICANN staff reading the question from Kathy Kleiman, a member of the working group. What about the very different laws around the world? What is legal in one country is illegal in others. How do we resolve this?
Okay, well, that's a very big question, but I think the way we're focused on it in the working group is requests coming from law enforcement agencies. Now, obviously, there are definitional issues there, and the issue of the recognition of law enforcement agencies from outside the jurisdiction. But it's obviously not we haven't gotten to the point of whether a particular activity is legal or not. Kieran, I think, and then...
This is Kieran Malinchari-Ville. I apologize for the state of my voice. I'm hoping it lasts for the next 30 minutes, but I'll be brief. I have two concerns with the jurisdiction section that Dick brought up. My first is that when you limit the applicability of the ability of law enforcement to respond to certain jurisdictions, then I think that this is going to cause a problem of privacy proxy services flight to those jurisdictions where they're almost unreachable. So, for example, Frank Schilling may have 1,000 new neighbors in the Cayman Islands as a result of this, and so then, poor law enforcement is going to be completely frustrated. And there's no point at all to any of the recommendations that relate to the ability of law enforcement to go after criminals hiding behind privacy proxy shields. I think that I think that's all I have to say about it at this point. I know there's a lot more discussion to come on the jurisdiction issue, so I think I'll wait until we get into more details about this. I think, like Steve noted, we haven't really spoken about this in depth. Thanks.
Thank you, Kieran. I think McKaylee is next. Does anybody else want to be? Carlton? David? I'm sorry.
McKaylee Nayland for the record. Around this thing around jurisdiction and law enforcement, I appreciate the concern that that Dick and others have raised on this matter. I can understand that. The issue and the concern that a lot of us would have is the scenarios that we're seeing at the moment. I'm actively involved with Amnesty International, and we're getting emails almost every single day about bloggers in Saudi Arabia being flogged 60 times or 100 times or more than that. We're looking at serious human rights abuses. Now, I'm not, but hold on, there's more to it. If you look at how some of the CCTLDs have dealt with this issue, what they've done there is that they've provided mechanisms, excuse me, I'm having the same problem as Kieran, mechanisms by which law enforcement agencies can request the data, but only under particular specific circumstances for addressing specific types of crime. So I said something nasty about Volcker, doesn't make the bar. I'm disseminating child abuse material, definitely does. There's a list. You can define a list. Maybe that's the way to look at resolving this. For us as an Irish company, I'm very conscious and very, very sensitive to restrictions around what data I can and cannot share, but I have absolutely no interest in running any kind of service that helps serious crime. Define it narrowly enough, and I'm pretty sure a lot of us won't have an issue. Leave it far too open, and we're going to be arguing about this in a year's time. Thanks.
Thank you. I think we have a question from the chat, then we'll go to Carlton and David. Anybody else want to be in the queue, or can we wrap up the queue on this at that point?
Not so much a question, but a short comment from Don, our chair. And he says he's tagging a little bit onto Kathy Kleiman's earlier question, and he says that... What is or isn't considered law enforcement will vary.
Good point. Carlton?
Yes, I wanted to comment, follow up on Michaela's point. We have to have a framework in which we consider purpose as a means to determine how we handle extraterritorial requests. And I would think we would want to go at least give some measure of endorsement to the European view that MLATs, Mutual Legal Assistance Treaties, would be the gold standard by which you would use to respond to purposeful requests. So first, we have to establish that the purpose, and there are several purposes where we would entertain extra legal requests, extraterritorial requests, And then it would be, first of all, in the context of MLATs, and then other things further down the line.
Thank you, Carlton. David?
Yeah, to echo what sort of what Carlton said, we have established mechanisms for dealing with these tricky cases. We have MLATs and Interpol and so on, but we do understand that those are old mechanisms. They are very slow in practice. They are not practical for a world in which we have to deal with, internet moves a lot faster and a lot automated quantities, and those mechanisms may not, be useful. And at the moment, we kind of mostly hope to work around that by, as Michele says, registrars don't want to be seen as being involved in serious criminal activity, but there is, they have to make their own judgment when there is a grey area. There is a big problem here. It is possibly solvable. There are people trying to solve it. I mean, talk to Bertrand de la Chapelle, and he will talk to you for a long time about the complexities of this problem and how to solve it. And we are not going to solve it in this working group. We are going to have to come up with a compromise for now that we will refine later as people chip away at this very big problem. Thank you.
Thank you, David. So we'll have one more comment here, and then we'll move on to our remaining one or two slides and further questions.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I've been listening to the comments of one of our friends over here. Certainly, there is an issue being faced by the law enforcement agency. One suggestion has come about the mutual legal assistance treaty, MLAT. But I must say that the mutual legal assistance treaty largely have entered, which encompassing the physical issues also. This is a issue, more cyber issues, solution need to be come out in a very quickly there. So we need to look at whether the mutual legal treaty, that kind of arrangement will work in these cases. In India, is a little more religious communities are there. We find the riots happen, there's a destructions happen with the lives as well as the physical property there. And we have seen our experiences that most of the domains which are registered behind the privacy protection, they are all abused. Issues who decide the abuse, is the registrar or the registry decide whether it is abuse or not abuse, are they better than the law enforcement agency to decide that this is not abuse and law enforcement agencies, they go at variance with the law enforcement agencies. We need to find a solution, certainly. And the issue becomes much more serious when it is a cross-jurisdictional issues are there. I agree with my friend there. We need to find a solution, particularly in a place from which side of the country which I come from is a serious issue there. We must make the process for the getting the details as simple as we make for registration domain behind the privacy protection. We must make the process simple there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that perspective. So let's turn to the next. Let me turn it back to Graham to walk us through the remaining slides, and then again we'll have more time for discussion.
Thank you, Steve. So this is a fun one that we've spent a considerable amount of time on, and is certainly the subject, I think, of a number of the public comments already. Steve is choking. I'm sure he's fine. So there's quite a division within the working group on this question, and we talked earlier about use of privacy and proxy services, and we all agreed that there is no need to distinguish between who can use privacy and proxy services. That means you can be an individual, an organization, a company, a commercial organization doing business, So anybody can use it. It doesn't matter who you are. It does possibly matter what you're doing. And so this text was proposed by some members of the working group, and it is domains used for online financial transactions for commercial purpose should be ineligible for privacy and proxy registrations. And certainly there are many within the working group who disagree. And there are two annexes on the initial report describing both of those positions, and I would encourage everyone to read those and provide us with input in the comment period, as that would be very helpful to help us tease this question apart. There's not a whole lot more to say on that other than just to make sure that distinction is clear, that anyone can use privacy and proxy services. It's just that you may become ineligible if you are doing commercial online financial transactions for a commercial purpose. So that would exclude non-commercial purposes for doing transactions, for instance. I think that's relatively straightforward and should be quite clear, and is certainly a topic that we've spent lots of time on, and I would be interested in seeing if there's anyone we haven't heard from who has thoughts on this matter. I don't see any hands. What?
You limited to people you hadn't heard from.
I did. Stephanie has put her hand up. Stephanie, please.
I invite anybody else to jump in first because you have heard from me. Okay, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. Just for greater clarity, could you describe further what we mean by those words you just said, financial transactions for a commercial purpose? So in other words, if I'm a charity, donations to my registered charity are not for a commercial purpose. Is that correct?
That's a good question. I don't have that answer. I don't know that we've gone too far down the road of really teasing apart what we meant by commercial transaction. You know, and certainly we've talked about this a bunch, about there's a donate button on a journalist blog, or you know, donations especially come up in many contexts, and whether those would count.
Perhaps I'd just like to put on the record then that as we as a committee go through the comments which we receive on this, we need to be sure that the people commenting have it crystal clear in their minds, and this is a matter where the legal framework varies considerably from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Thank you.
I'm seeing lots of hands coming up now. I am shocked and amazed. We've got a question in the chat. I'm going to go to Mary. We've got about 23 minutes left. Am I right?
Correct. This is Mary from staff, but it's not so much a comment from the chat, although there may be. I haven't looked in the last 30 seconds. But more to follow up on Stephanie's question. The working group's initial report does propose not a formulation or a definition, but some sort of framework for your question. The intent is not just financial transactions that take place online, but financial transactions that take place online that are associated with commercial activities. And I believe that is the language used in the initial report by the working group.
That's helpful. Thank you, Mary. I've got Volker and then Kieran, and then I saw a couple hands on this side, if you can. It was Christian. Okay. And Ollie.
I've regaled this before, but here's a real-life example of a company that I've recently used for private financial transaction. This is a service based in the UK. On their website, they have their contact details as required under European law for service providers of any kind. They offer money transmission services to any country in the world. That is, in my book, as much as financial transaction as you can get. You can send money to other people or to yourself in other countries. They accept cash or transfers. You can pick up the money at the location or have it transferred to a bank account. But they use domains by proxy, which is, in my book, under my understanding, still the privacy proxy service used by GoDaddy. Now, I've thought about this, and I don't really see anything wrong with this site using this service. Is there any danger involved in using this site using this service? Is there any danger involved in any other legitimate site using privacy proxy service, even if they offer financial transactions? It's a question that I've asked myself. I've done some research on the site. They seem legitimate. Money arrived. So I have no problems with that. The only question is, should we really regulate them out of their privacy service? There might be legitimate reasons why they use it. I don't know why. Maybe they don't own the domain name and only rent it. There could be a dozen of reasons, but I don't know if we should take the place of legislators and say they must say also on the Whois, even though they say it on the site, who they are. Otherwise, they won't be able to provide the service or have a domain name.
Thanks, Volker. I've got Karen next.
So I think that one of the things that's really important to note as we kind of frame these discussions and frankly don't get off on tangents, multiple tangents, is that this is still a threshold question and that we haven't really gotten to the issues surrounding implementation. So, for example, my position would probably on charitable donations would have to take into account the fact that over $3 billion are diverted from legitimate charitable organizations every year by various criminal actors that are posing as charities and collecting the donations that would have gone to, you know, like legitimate foundations. That doesn't all happen online, and I certainly have no information or numbers associated with, you know, what percentage of those fraudsters are using privacy proxy services. But there are lots of things to look at with this, and I think that we need to be reminded where we are in the process of discussing this question. We're only trying to figure out if it's a question we're looking at. And, you know, I think we brought up in the GNSO session over the weekend some of the language that was out there on the outreach sites on this issue about, you know, which was frankly extremely fear-mongering in the community. Oh, you know, we're going to be monitoring your website. We're going to be taking down this website. And this specific instance is going to result in this person's privacy shield being taken down. And we don't know the answers to those questions yet because this group hasn't actually looked at how this is going to be applied and how it's going to be implemented. So I would like to see this discussion become a little bit more measured back into what the report is actually asking of us, which is, are there circumstances where this, you know, this distinction, this permissible uses should even be considered by this group? And I think that the fact that there are so many questions out there means that the answer to that is clearly yes, and that we should actually move forward to discussing implementation. Because there are a lot of concerns and there's a lot of misinformation, and we need to start discussing it. Thanks.
Sorry, missed my microphone. I've got a couple of people ahead of the online queue that I'm going to go to first, which is Christian and then Ollie, and then Michele and Stephanie. And then we've got about only 18 minutes from now, so let's keep it relatively quick, and hopefully we can dip into some of the implementation issues that we might be able to hear about. So please.
I think it's very, very fair to at least foreshadow the idea of implementation. I, for one, am not convinced at all that there is value. In fact, I mostly see destructive value in the idea of doing this in the first place. When you take a look at how implementation would have to work and you realize that there seems to be a great deal of gray area, seems to be a great deal of difficulty in understanding what the criteria are, you realize that there's going to be a very difficult arbitration process that's going to be required for something like this. There's going to be a very difficult negotiation process of how exactly this is going to work and potentially a great deal of cost. And so I think it's fair to say, as you are trying to determine whether there is value in doing this, to balance it against the difficulty in doing this. And so that's where I think that it is very reasonable to at least foreshadow implementation. And in this case, my feeling is that with the extreme difficulty that I expect there is in implementing this, and in my mind, a very low value or even negative value in doing this, it's a deterrent value, that it should be something that we do not accept moving forward.
Thanks, Christian. Ollie?
Thanks. Yeah, Ollie Hope. It's a similar point actually to what you just said. I was just sort of looking at it, thinking the difficulty of putting this in, the complexity, the problems that it will cause, and I'm sure there are many arguments for it. We've heard one. There are also many arguments against it. So it's almost like it's a balanced view, it seems. I think the weight of it ends up being that, yeah, it should be discussed, but I just don't think it can work. It can't be done. I also think you have to be very, very clear in the definition, because the wording that was up there, it said, you know, the domain name is used for financial transactions. Well, how far do we go down that line? But I assume it means the content on the website that the domain points to. But if that domain then points to a CCTLD that doesn't have any of these restrictions, and the content on that website, you know, does that apply? Does that not? These are just parts of the reasons why it's so difficult. But I think before you almost get to that, you know, that definition is key. And I'll be quiet now. Thank you.
Thanks, Ollie. We're back up into the Adobe queue now for Michele. Right, okay.
Paul McGrady. Another topic that I think that needs to be discussed in relationship to this is who will have the burden. Will the provider have the burden to be constantly looking through all the second-level registrations to see what they're doing? Or will there be a reporting and then action based upon that reporting by an aggrieved party? I think that those are two very different things with very different burden models. And so as we continue to discuss this issue, I think we need to take a look at that issue. Thank you.
Interesting. Thanks. Now, Michele.
Thanks, Graham. I think there's one thing that I think there's some language people have been using. Sorry, Michele, name for the record. Some language that some people have been using that does cause a certain degree of confusion. I don't think it's particularly helpful. We're talking about the domain name and the who is for the domain name. Mixing that up a lot of the time with the website sites and things like that is confusing. Because what we're seeing in some conversations is, you know, website X uses who is privacy. Well, actually, it doesn't. The domain name, which is just part of the website, does. Now, you could see this being slightly pedantic, but in many respects, it's actually not, because we come across a lot of websites where the website itself is made up of multiple host names, content served from multiple host names that make the entire thing up, that constitute the website. I mean, the points that a couple people have raised around, you know, when this goes to implementation, if it goes to implementation, I mean, the example I look at is a lot of our clients are more than happy to publish their full contact details on their websites, and as they are obliged to do under Irish law if they're commercial entities. But they do choose to not publish their details in the WHOIS and on GTLDs, because the WHOIS on GTLDs is not protected. Now, in the CCTLD space, this is not an issue, because the CCTLD space is either minimal WHOIS output, both for commercial, non-commercial, business, private, whatever, but is also protected. You talk to any CCTLD manager, and they will quite happily tell you that their WHOIS servers are rate limited in some way or another, whereas in the GTLD space, theoretically at least, there aren't any limitations. And there are a bunch of companies out there that are selling people's data, and that data is being used for spam, it's being used for sending fake renewal notices, and a whole load of other things. Whereas if we're talking about the websites and what they do or don't do, then surely that's a matter for law enforcement, for the consumer protection people. Why is it a matter for the WHOIS?
Thanks, Michele. We're not going to have time to get into some of the information stuff, so we can carry on here. And then we have a summary slide or two, don't we? Oh, and there's another meeting at 5, so we've got a few more minutes. I see Stephanie and then Volker. Is there anybody else in the queue? Holly? All right, Stephanie.
Thanks, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. And oddly enough, Michele and I appear to be on the same wavelength here, so I can be brief. For some of us, there is a deep and abiding concern that I can stay within its remit, and that being related to the domain name and how that is managed and the information associated with it. So, indeed, what happens on the website is outside of ICANN's remit, except insofar, of course, as if law enforcement comes to investigate what they consider is a crime, and the only data they can get would be through the reveal process or the disclosure process on this, well, fine, then they go through due process and exercise that. But drawing this bright line is very difficult, and determining why somebody purchases a domain name, and I'll use an example. I purchased a domain name 7 or 8 years ago, which sooner or later I may use to sell my book on data protection law. I urge you all to buy a copy. In the meantime, why can't I have a privacy proxy service for that name? How is the privacy proxy service provider going to determine what my intention for using that website is until somebody gets, you know, this is a mug's game. How would a service provider manage that and make the determination? It falls into that category that A, ICANN shouldn't be doing it, and B, the cost if they did do it would be prohibitive. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. We've got probably about 6 or so minutes left. We need to hear from Volker, Holly, and then Steve. You wanted in the queue.
Thanks, Graham. Volker Greimann speaking again. I'm going to say something heretical. It probably would get me stoned in some countries. I've given the entire idea of an accreditation program a lot of thought, and it has come to me that possibly the accreditation of such providers is not the best idea. We might want to look at alternatives such as a more lightweight alternative, such as a certification process. Just bear in mind that if we create an accreditation program, we are essentially creating a third contracted parties group, very closely affiliated with registrars in some cases, not at all affiliated with registrars in other cases, that would have to appear at ICANN, currently have no voice at ICANN, but they would be suddenly here as a contracted party, required to come where they have currently not had that cost before. Also, the accreditation program carries very high requirements for it is cost intensive for ICANN and for the providers. It has it will probably require a fee which would price the services higher than they currently are, and all this could be avoided if we do not go the process of an accreditation but rather follow a certification route. Of course, this would require certain amendments in the RAA and other agreements and other processes, but I think those could be done. And I would like the group to give this just some thought to for further discussions.
Thanks, Volker. Holly? Kabani?
I think we're sort of on the same length, but come up with different answers. I was asked, why did we decide in the beginning to lump privacy and proxy providers together? Because privacy, actually, servers generally are registrars of one kind or another, but proxy can be just a lawyer, actually an agent. And if you're starting to say, we have to now have accredited for lawyers who are, is that what we're saying? I don't think so. So, I mean, when I was asked about compliance and I suddenly thought, is ICANN going to be running after a bunch of lawyers for being an agent? I got a little sort of doubt in my mind.
That's a delightful one to bring up with 2 minutes left. Thank you, Holly. Much appreciated. I've got 2 minutes left or so, and then we've got Steve and I'm...
Thanks. It's Vicki Scheckler with the IPC, for the record. As I've been listening to the conversation, I'm struck by how much there's discussion of, I think the answer is X, Y, and Z, and not so much specifics in terms of how you got to that position or how you support that position. So as we move forward, as we get public comments, I, for one, would appreciate having more specifics. If it's cost prohibitive, what are the costs? You know, in my world, if I make a complaint, you want to know what the evidence is behind that complaint. I am happy to share that with you. I'm happy to share with you how we got to that point. But I think that if we dig a little deeper and have a data-driven process, we'll get to a better result. Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki. That's an excellent suggestion. Steve?
Yes, thank you. I've found this discussion actually more revelatory than I anticipated. And I'm not just talking about the Volcker and Holly's revelations that after 18 months of donating every Tuesday to this discussion, they think maybe it's not worthwhile. I'm not going to stone Volcker because I have no stones at hand, but what I wanted to say was I think Christian had raised an important point here on this question, which is we probably should look at the principle and at the implementation. Now, I know Christian's view is that the principle is not worth carrying forward. I think I disagree with that, but I think there really are serious implementation issues that would need to be resolved. So it's just something to think about as to whether this could be identified as a principle that if we can fashion a way to do so, that ought to be incorporated into the accreditation program that Volcker is going to boycott now, and then recognize that there are serious implementation issues. And the last characters on this last slide show that we have a deadline, and so we have to be very mindful of that deadline as well. I just thought that was an interesting way of approaching this, and I want to thank everyone for their contributions. Do we have any?
No, I think that's just about it. We need to be out of here in a couple minutes, so comment period is still open for another 2 weeks or so. Please submit. And a thank you for everyone attending, members of the working group, fellow co-chair Steve and Don, who is not with us today, and especially staff. Thank you, everyone.